This is Going Public on KRCU, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. When it comes to cancer treatment, one size does not fit all. KRCU's To Your Health host, Brooke Hildebrand Clubs, recently sat down with Dr. Ryan Fields, Associate Professor of Surgical Oncology at Washington University School of Medicine and the Siteman Cancer Center to discuss individualized cancer treatments, like the one that recently worked so well for President Jimmy Carter.
President Jimmy Carter's cancer treatment may be something a lot of our listeners have heard about. His melanoma was treated with a drug that ramps up the body's immune system. Because his brain and liver now show no sign of disease, people might think that drug is now the miracle cure for cancer. However, that's not really an accurate understanding of cancer biology. So, Dr. Fields, can you tell us more about how each person's DNA can be taken into account when determining the best cancer treatment?
Yeah, I mean, I think suffice to say we're in the midst of a revolution in cancer care, and that includes cancer diagnosis and treatment. And it used to be we kind of had three pillars of cancer treatment. It was surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. And by chemotherapy in that statement, I mean chemotherapy that's the kind that a lot of people are used to that is essentially a poison that just poisons the cancer quicker than it poisons the rest of the body, but has a lot of side effects, people losing their hair and being pretty sick, and it's not very specific to a particular cancer type or to a particular patient's cancer. Well, now we kind of have these two new, what I would call pillars of cancer treatment, and one of them is, just as you alluded to, is really gets at the genetics or the DNA of one person's cancer. And that means that a patient like Jimmy Carter, who has melanoma, will be treated differently than a patient with, say, a colon cancer. So it's cancer-specific, but it's also patient-specific, meaning if I had a melanoma versus Jimmy Carter's melanoma, they may be treated very differently because the DNA, the genetics of my melanoma would be different. So, you know, gone are the days where we would give a tumor sample to a pathologist and they would look at it under the old light microscope and give us all the information we could get. We still rely on that information quite a bit, but we can look one level deeper down to the molecular level, the DNA level, and that can help predict treatments that are going to work for patients. And these are typically much more directed or targeted treatments. They have a lot less side effects because they're really focused on one area of that tumor's genetics, and so they don't typically cause you to have the same your hair falling out and you getting real sick. They tend to affect the tumors specifically, and so that's just been a huge revolution in the genetics of cancer.
That's fantastic. So can you tell us a little bit more about, with these new pillars of cancer treatment, what does that look like individualized? Give us an example of when a patient comes in to you, what their individualized treatment might look like.
Yeah, so a lot of patients, and I'll use an example of melanoma in a moment, but kind of in general terms, it means that we're sending off tumor biopsies for very advanced molecular and genetic testing. And that's not just us. When I say us, it's not limited to just the academic centers like WashU. This is pretty standard cancer care now that's being done all around the country and around the world. For melanoma in particular, more than half of melanomas have a mutation, a change in a gene called BRAF. And when they have that particular mutation, they're eligible for one particular drug that targets that mutation. If they don't have the mutation, the drug won't help them. If they do, it will. And so because of that, that's a great test that we can sort of say, okay, this is the therapy that's going to work for you. The other therapies that have kind of been this other pillar in the cancer treatment are the immune therapies, and that's the example of Jimmy Carter. So a drug that essentially, quote, releases the brakes off the immune system, mm-hmm. allows your own body to recognize your cancer and fight it. So side effects are much different. There are side effects related to more autoimmune type diseases and the immune system getting a little too excited and attacking your own cells, but those are very manageable side effects, much less in general compared to typical chemotherapy. And the exciting thing about the immune therapies is when they work, they generally work for long periods of time. It's not common to throw out the term cure or remission for right. diseases like melanoma when they've spread, but we're starting to introduce those words into our vocabulary, which wow. is very exciting. And as you can imagine, President Carter in his 90s, he tolerated the treatment very well and was back to doing the things he wanted to do, teaching Sunday school. So there are therapies we can use in the young and in older patients and very effectively. So in practice, we do a lot of this advanced testing on a patient's tumor to be able to tailor the treatment to them, what people have called precision or personalized medicine, where your treatment is really not just a guideline that says do this. It's based on a lot of very important tests on your particular tumor.
And, you know, when you mentioned the immunology component of this, one of the things your research is pointing to are certain vaccines mm-hmm. that might help patients. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, so I mean, people think when you use the word vaccine, they think of something like a measles vaccine or a polio right. vaccine that's going to prevent it from ever happening. Most of what we're talking about in this day and age is not necessarily a preventative vaccine, but a therapeutic vaccine that we'd actually use as part of their treatment. So what if you had an advanced cancer, could we use a vaccine strategy to boost your immune system and get it to fight the tumor? So could we take a drug like the one President Carter was on that kind of allows the immune system to do its job and then kind of teach it what it needs to fight against using a vaccine? So the analogy is the immune system's kind of suppressed by the cancer. We release that suppression with a drug and then give this vaccine to say, okay, go fight that, just like you would a flu shot, you know, fight that flu bug, fight that cancer cell. And the vaccine would be a very specific vaccine to each patient because the changes in the tumor that I have may be different than someone else's. The analogy is the flu shot changes every year based right. on the strains of flu. This needs to be that specific for a patient's individual cancer.
Wow. So you're saying that some of these things are already available, that they're already becoming the standard of care. What would someone who gets a cancer diagnosis today want to expect from their treatment based on these advancements?
Yeah. So, I mean, the diseases, especially if we focus on immune therapy, for example, where they've really become the standard of care are things like melanoma, renal cell cancer, kidney cancer, and lung cancer, certain types of lung cancer. These immune therapies have really become standard treatments. And so there are tests that will be done on a patient's tumor when they come and see their oncologist that will direct the type of therapy they'll get from day one. And then that the idea is we can select the right therapy for the right patient that has the highest chance of working. And if it works, we continue those types of therapies. And again, with these immune therapies, often these responses are very long-lasting, durable responses with excellent quality of life, meaning if you saw somebody on one of these treatments walking down the street, you wouldn't look at them and think they were a cancer patient with advanced cancer when they're doing the things they want to do and that sort of thing.
Just that quality of life component
yeah.
is so amazing. I mean, we're so used to seeing folks who lose their hair, are, you know, so tired all of the time. And so it's really eliminating. Sometimes people almost say that the side effects are worse than the disease. And so that in itself is a great advancement.
It's been a huge advance, I think. Now, it's not the panacea. It's not the perfect
right.
treatment. There still are certainly side effects. And it's going to sound, people may take a deep breath when I sort of say this, but, you know, the response rates to a lot of these immune therapies is, you know, 30-40%, which to us are incredible because
right.
what we had 2 years ago, 5 years ago were things that were 1 or 2% effective.
Mm-hmm.
To most patients, most people would sort of say, well, 30-40%, there's a lot of room for improvement. We'd really like this to work 90% of the time.
Right.
And so that's really where the active research is right now. How can we improve the responses in certain cancer types and apply them to other cancer types? And even better, how can we predict which immune therapy is going to work best for which patient? Because now that we have several options, you'd really like to know up front, okay, can I order a blood test or test this patient's tumor and say, you're most likely going to benefit from this one or this combination? And that's really where people are really excited about where the research is moving.
Are there some cancers that don't seem to be responding to these new therapies?
Yeah, a lot of the therapies, what we know of right now that are responsive to immune therapies in particular, are ones that have a lot of mutations, a lot of changes in the genetic code. And those tend to be cancers that are exposed to a high degree of carcinogens or cancer-causing mm-hmm. agents, so lung cancer from cigarette smoke typically, melanoma from excessive UV exposure. And so those are the ones that really respond well because by definition they've undergone a lot of changes, so they're foreign to the body if we can get the body to react to them. The cancers that are a little bit more challenging right now are things like pancreas cancer, brain cancer, glioblastoma, even colon cancer, for the majority of colon cancers, where there's just not a huge number of genetic changes. So that's where the idea of these vaccine strategies really mm-hmm. comes in. Can we take the smaller number of mutations and use a vaccine to really boost the immune response? Therapy in some of these other tumors to these very aggressive and cancers with fewer treatment options.
So are there any other new directions in research that you're seeing right now that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I think, you know, one area of very active research is really on the diagnostic side and the sort of cancer screening and high risk patient sort of cohort, meaning can we catch a cancer before it's even formed? So things like colon polyps or pre-malignant lesions, moles that are abnormal, can we have a way of predicting those beforehand, catching them early and removing them or treating them before they turn into a more aggressive cancer? Can we pick up a signal in the body in a non-invasive way that's going to allow us to predict the formation of cancer? And so that's a real exciting area of research. And what's allowed that to really take off is it used to be it'd be really hard to pick out a very low-level signal in the blood, but a lot of the new genetic testing, a lot of the genomics applications where literally from a drop of blood we can get that so much information because we can look so deeply into that has really changed that. So that, I think, is one of the more exciting areas of research, because if we could prevent the cancer from forming in the first place, it would obviously be much better than treating it later on.
Well, Dr. Fields, thank you so much for all of your great work, and thank you for coming to talk with us today here at KRCU.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was KRCU's To Your Health host, Brooke Hildebrand Clubs, and Dr. Ryan Fields, Associate Professor of Surgical Oncology at Washington University School of Medicine and the Siteman Cancer Center. More from KRCU's Going Public after the break.
I'm Ari Shapiro. If you find NPR reliable and comforting, you're not alone. If your old car is a bit less than reliable, well, you're not alone either. Donate your car to us and turn it into the programs you love.
Visit krcu.org and click on support for all the details.
We're back with Going Public on KRCU, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. The new exhibition, Reconstructed, Reconceptualized, examines the link between the banjo and African string instruments. Ahead of the exhibition's September 1st opening at the Chris Museum, I sat down with its creator, Nijjar Abdul Musawir, an associate professor of fine arts at Southern Illinois University, to find out what exactly that link is.
The link is the contribution made to America by those individuals who were taken from their home in Africa and brought to America and put into slavery. And I would say at this point, there's no such thing as an African slave. What it is an African put into slavery. And so what happened is that during slavery, Africans made things and created things that remind them of home. Even the shotgun house, Tora, who's known as a person who came on a slave ship, said that when he saw a shotgun house, it reminded him of Africa. So there was certain things that were happening in America that made them think about Africa. And the banjo or the string instrument was one of them. And Africa is well known for its string instruments, where some of them have one string all the way up to 21 strings.
Well, tell me about some of those instruments. What do they look like? What do they sound like?
Well, one of the great things about it, I listened to quite a bit of it when I was at the Smithsonian doing some research at the African Art Museum. And it depends on the instrument itself, because some of the instruments, you know, they made out of calabash wood, and then they have the leather skin, much like that we see today. And some of them look like harps, and they almost sound like some have a harp-like sound. And then you have those that look like the banjo or guitar that has another similar sound. Like, have you ever heard a cigar box guitar?
Mm-hmm.
Some of the older ones sound like that. But the newer ones, because of technology, they have a really more sophisticated and innovative sound because of technology. But nevertheless, the old ones still have great sounds. And it's interesting watching someone play with one string. You know, you hit a string, but it's way the pressure of the fingers, the movements of the fingers, and that gave it multiple sounds, not just one sound. If I was to compare it, I would compare it with maybe the violin, the fiddle, and other string instruments.
Well, how did the banjo find prominence in the U.S., especially in the American South? We're talking about slavery, as you mentioned before, but how did it go to the next level at that point?
Well, no, it's kind of interesting because not only did they make string instruments, they also made drums. They made things to make sound. And during slavery, you know, they weren't allowed to have drums, and they really weren't allowed to do anything other than labor or whatever they was told to do. And what happened is that some plantations allowed them to use during weddings. So when they allowed slaves to get married or have certain a baby's born, they allowed them to play those string instruments that they had created, as well as some drums. And so they would sing these songs, and they would just, you know, it became part of the religious activities of the slaves. And the banjo would be one instrument that they would, you know, reference. And it really didn't take hold until some white Southern businessmen decided to create their own banjo. And because banjo had been played basically by poor whites, knew more about the banjo than the white population. But it really didn't take hold until, as a commodity, until they started marketing. And the question is, why would they market a banjo? And I think they did it because they knew the banjo was a very important contribution to America. Why? Thomas Jefferson stated, President Thomas Jefferson stated that one of the greatest contributions Africa made to America was the banjo, because the banjo brought a great amount of pleasure as an instrument, but also it also became a commodity. And so when they decided to market it, and this is a trip, when they decided to market, they attacked the character of the African string instrument, which is, we know is the banjo in America, as though it was not sophisticated enough or elevated enough to be considered, that it was really just garbage. They even said that, we're going to create a more sophisticated, more elevated, more unique banjo, not that disgusting, you know, crude, you know, unsophisticated banjo, the African banjo, as they refer to it. I found some of these ads when I was at the Warner M. Robbins Library at the African Museum. And I'm looking at these ads. I'm like, wow. I mean, they just straight up had a strong marketing strategy to attack the African string instrument, but at the same time, imitated, you know, or create a banjo that they can claim as their own. And so, also, another thing is they also took the opportunity to market it to the minstrel shows, to white artists, to white banjo players who had to put on black faces if they were going to perform. You see, and so that's a sad commentary, because according to some of the things that I read, little notes, it appears that they wanted to play the banjo. They wanted to be a musical artist, but the only way they can make a livelihood is they put the blackface.
Well, let's talk about the exhibition. What can people expect from it?
I think people are going to be really pleased with the fact that they're able to look at something that connects them both to America and also to Africa. There's this connection between what is here and what is there. I'm hoping that they get from the show is that the idea of sustainability, the idea of preserving, you know, what seems to be very simple, to understand the complexities of it. And so when I went about creating these pieces, I used improvisation. I used different types of wood because they're constructed out of wood. And there's no hierarchy, meaning I created oak, cherry wood, walnut. No, some of that wood is in the piece, but I also use plywood, raw tree material. And I just respond to the aesthetic composition of the African string instruments and its relationship to the banjo. So, but then I look at this African string instrument and look at some of the composition and pull it into the banjo. And then also I did appeal to certain African aesthetics when it comes to mask making, textile patterns and things like that, in a very loose and abstract way. There are small pieces, there are huge pieces, and I have four large pieces, and I actually, the four large pieces, blue, green, red, yellow. The blue is the Atlantic Ocean. The green is the plantation. The red is the revolt, and the yellow is we standing under the sun. And so what I did was that I used that color to actually show a timeline of the banjo. So the Atlantic one says the Atlantic Ocean piece is a very large piece with one banjo sitting in the middle, looking like a slave ship moving in this huge blue space. And below the horizon line, you see a lot of burlap movement, loose burlap, dark blue. That's the bodies that were thrown over in the water. Not only that, slaves who died as a result those who were put into slavery, those Africans who had died, been forced into slavery. But even white who was on the ship got sick and they threw their body over in the ocean. And so here it is that the Banjo survived that. It became an object of survival once they got to America by playing it, by having that connection to Africa.
That was Nijjar Abdul-Musawir, an associate professor of fine arts at Southern Illinois University, talking with me about the link between the banjo and African string instruments for his new exhibition, Reconstructed, Reconceptualized, at the Chris Museum. To hear the stories from today, visit krcu.org or go to iTunes to hear this podcast. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Join me Friday nights at 6 and Sundays at 3 for KRCU's Going Public.